This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Jeffrey Smith. He has published The Geonomist and has won award for a California Green Light Award, which has appeared in both the popular radio press, Truth Out, and academic journals, including USC's Planning and Markets. He's conducted research for Portland's Mass Transit Agency and runs the site progress.org, as well as being a member of the International Society for Ecological Economics. He also has a new book out called Perfect Timing. Jeffrey Smith, it's great having you on the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. It is so nice to talk to people who take ideas seriously. It's great.
I think how we originally came into contact was it was on the Facebook forums for the basic income. That's an issue that you're very passionate about, but that's also a theme in your new science fiction novel, Perfect Timing.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's key. I think it's essential. I think it can be depoliticized, so it appeals completely across the political spectrum, and it can be won more easily than a lot of other proposals and have a greater impact. So that's why I focus on this, and that's why I wrote a story which incorporates that feature. The show of life could be better once we start sharing society surplus. And that's the backdrop for the story. That's not really the plot or anything like that. But it's the context, so people have to pick up on those ideas as they enjoy the story.
So the basic premise of the story is the main character, he is teleported into the future, and he explores this new world. And would you say it's more of a utopian future novel as opposed to, well, I guess science fiction novels about the future, they tend to be more disproportionately dystopian novels.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to entertain people more than a utopian novel. Like, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, that's known everywhere. But his other novel, Island, which was more utopian, is barely known at all. So it just appeals to human nature, problems and challenges and things going wrong and all that.
How far in the future is the novel set?
It's between a century and two centuries into the future, far enough ahead so that time travel can be possible, but not yet perfected. Because he sucked from our time into that future time accidentally. They have perfected a chronoscope that lets them look through time, but they haven't been able to travel through time yet until accidentally this chronoscope backfires and sucks the person they've been looking at into the future. It's like a lot of great discoveries were accidental, like graphene, for instance, and many other things are accidental.
Would you say that the basic income is the key theme of the new future society, or more just one of the many factors?
No, I'd say it's key if it's done properly, because there wouldn't be any more poverty for one thing, there'd be plenty of leisure for another, and if it's done properly, it wouldn't be just take from the rich, give to the poor and everybody else. It would be actually divvying up equally society's surplus. And the surplus is the value of nature, of natural resources, of land, of electromagnetic spectrum, and things like that, which have tremendous economic value, but it didn't take anybody's labor or capital to create them. And in the past, not the future, but in the past, people understood that we had a natural heritage of these things. And that notion has been lost, and this book tries to resurrect it. So nobody feels like they're taking from anybody else. Everybody feels like they're just getting their fair share. Sort of like in Alaska, where every resident gets a dividend check from oil revenue.
And that's an interesting point, because there's different proposals for basic income. Is your idea closer to the idea of a social credit than it is generating the revenue through taxation?
Well, I guess not really, because the surplus exists right now. It's just going to the 1%, And that's why we have, you know, class and hierarchy and bullying by these privileged people. So it doesn't take from what they have. The idea is just to redirect the spending stream so that it goes through the public treasury and back out as a dividend to everybody. So no, it's not printing money that didn't exist before. And no, it's not, you know, tapping other people's assets. It's something different. It's just, like I say, redirecting the spending. And what's interesting, the only basic income equivalents are on this model, like Alaska, as I mentioned, and Singapore. It has a social surplus, a budget surplus, and it has a higher rate on its land tax than most other places, and that creates that surplus. And Aspen, Colorado, another example, they help every working family afford to live there. The money comes from the value of the locations there. So it's a model that's in practice and operating, and it's not necessary to dream up other schemes that might not work as well.
In the future, the big issue is going to be automation, and that's going to remove a lot of jobs. So, I mean, it will be absolutely necessary for there to be a basic income. I think there will be a debate about this, because I think it is inevitable there will be some kind of basic income. But if it's done the wrong way, you could see a lot of former middle-class jobs displaced and replaced with a basic income at poverty level. So I think it is crucial that we work towards a basic income, but there are possible scenarios where it could be done the wrong way.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%, Robert. And, you know, a lot of the jobs that people perform right now really are not truly productive. They're more or less conformist. And, you know, like telephone solicitors and a lot of other jobs that they disappeared, nobody would be worse off. And if people didn't have to spend those 40 hours a week just qualifying for an income without producing value to the rest of society, they could get a life. They could contribute in different ways. They might become an artist. They might become, well, like down here in Mexico, they got hundreds, if not thousands, of people who helped the biologists count the monarchs because they were threatened, their habitat was threatened. And people banded together to do this count to know if they're surviving and where and what to do about it. So if people had a lot more free time, they could do stuff like that, you know, take care of them. Homeless pets, you know, older people, et cetera, foster a kid. There's a lot to do that creates social value that it's not tied to the job.
And yeah, we are in kind of a post-scarcity economy because we have a surplus of food because of factory farming, and we have a lot of cheap merchandise at Walmart that we import from China. So the food and the goods are being produced on a large scale. So we have this surplus, but the problem is we have this notion that trying to find jobs for everyone and having employment, but we need to kind of rethink things in the context of a post-scarcity economy.
Oh, heck yeah. Really, really true. And if you look at the history of the work week, it's not always been 40. It's been worse than that. In the early days of industrialization, but it's been a lot better than that in different times in the past. Like in Europe, after the Black Plague eliminated a third to a half of the population, and in the Middle Ages, the so-called Dark Ages, after the plague swept through Europe, there was so much good land available for the survivors that they could negotiate a greater income, and they would use that for greater leisure. So the work week was like 14 hours. And then there was this guy, Salins, historical economist, looked at the Stone Age. That was his famous book, Stone Age Economics. And supposedly, the work week back then was 2 hours. So this notion that everybody has to work 40 hours is totally artificial. It could be cut down. According to Juliet Shore of Harvard, I think she's at Boston University, but when she wrote her book, Overworked American, the work week could have been whittled down to 6.5 hours a week if all the increase in productivity apply to that instead of just enriching a very few pockets. So we could do it now. We, even without more automation, we could do it now. Said Robert, we're going to have to do it later. So sooner the better.
I noticed on your book cover, is that those giant flowers sculptures from Singapore?
Yeah. You know, I think the artist did get them from there. But the notion actually is to have living material. And you can grow your building. They don't have to chop down trees. And I subscribe to these different lists for technological progress. And some of these ideas that I put in this book are actually starting to come true, which is kind of cool, kind of amazing, too.
Is your book influenced by Ecotopia? And can you talk about the theme that ecology plays in the book? Or it's actually called Geotopia. Geotopia is the name of the future utopia, but it's a play on Ecotopia.
That's right. That's right. And Ernest Kallenbach, I knew somewhat. He was a nice guy. He even edited one of my previous nonfiction works, not an entire book, but he agreed completely with the geonomic principles of shifting taxes off efforts onto natural assets and shifting subsidies away from things like corporate welfare into this dividend for everybody. And I liked this book because I liked him and I agreed with his values and whatnot. They're my values as well. And I liked the strategy of using literature to create a vision for people. And, you know, that's pretty well established, like the book Utopia itself. And literature has played a role in the environmental movement, like Silent Spring and so forth. So I thought it was a great strategy to try, and I wanted to try to create a positive vision that people could strive for, or at least expect to happen, if it's not politically active, but just hope for it to happen, talk about it, create that critical mass. And it's a little bit different from Ecotopia in that I spent a lot of time studying how to write a story. Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey and many other books. And so I tried to enliven it more so than Ecotopia was and have a stronger plot with a stronger twist and surprises and make the story survive on its own without the architecture of wild technological progress and wild social progress. And so that if you have a great idea for a story and a great idea for policy reform, bring them together and see what happens.
You're an advocate of geonomics, and your site that you published is called The Geonomist. Is that similar to Georgism and Henry George?
Yeah, that would be the intellectual lineage. And there's others. There's Tom Paine and Tom Jefferson and even William Penn, speaking of Pennsylvania. I think the first law ever passed in Pennsylvania was land tax law. But his children overthrew that once they came to power. But a lot of the colonies had the notion of a commonwealth. And for me, the environment and how we treat it and how it treats us back is key. I think that as people grow more sensitive to the needs of the ecosystem, that also makes it comfortable for people to entertain the notion of bringing down this really steep hierarchy that it's not benefiting anybody except for that 1% at the top. And a lot of people can be active for the environment without being active for social justice and vice versa. So this tries to combine the two. And I think there can't be any environmental resolution without it's going to sound Marxist, I don't mean it that way, but without a class resolution. And of course, I don't think there could be any class resolution without environmental justice either. So it's like Kalmbach's ecotopia, in the sense that pollution is prohibited and there's a lot of recycling and everything's organic and et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, there is this different distribution. I don't want to call it redistribution, because what we have now is redistribution. There are very few getting the Commonwealth for themselves. And that's the redistribution.
In the book, how do you use the story and fiction to explain these political themes? Is it very explicit, or does it come up more in the plot and the characters' interactions with other characters?
Yeah, okay. It's a quest. See, the people in the future, they're looking through their chronoscope at the people in the past to try to identify their founders. I mean, they know the people who won the idea. But if you look at social change, there are unsung heroes. Everybody knows Martin Luther King, and not everybody knows the lady who sat on the bus. And that's true for every movement. There are people that are really famous and familiar, but like a generation before them, there were unsung heroes. And look at the anti-slavery movement, speaking of Pennsylvania and Quakers and whatnot. What was his name? John Woolman Quincy, or Quincy Woolman? He started the anti-slavery movement by himself at the time when even Quakers owned slaves. And, you know, most people don't know about him. They might know about Abe Lincoln and so forth. So anyway, the people of the future are trying to identify who actually came up with these ideas and give that person credit. So they're looking through their chronoscope, and when they accidentally stuck somebody into their time, it was a character who in our time was a caterer in a really fancy house, mansion, and he stumbles across a cat burglar in the midst of stealing some jewels. And the owner stumbles across them. And so there's some gunfire just before the hero is sucked into the future. In the future, to keep their past intact and their space-time continuum intact, they have to send him right back to that moment when bullets are bearing down on him. But if he can prove he was their founder, then they don't want to kill their founder. So it's kind of a bind for everybody. And to prove he's their founder, he's rushing around Geotopia. Has only 24 hours to do it, trying to figure out what makes it such a economic paradise and a social paradise. And there's six principles that he has to discover. And so he finds himself in various situations with his helper, who could be his descendant. And so they're both chased by the one remaining law enforcement officer. He's a volunteer because there's so little crime, there's no more police force, and so little war, there's no more military. So they're not really competent. The future's not really competent. And things we take for granted today, like tracking down fugitives and so forth. So it's supposed to be a comedy of errors, supposed to be a fish out of water story, and it's supposed to be somewhat farcical, playing on the values of today.
What are the six core principles that he is seeking?
Okay. He doesn't know what they are, but they are, the economy is based on the ecosystem. And the ecosystem keeps in balance, dynamic balance, not static, through feedback loops, positive and negative. So those are the first two tenets that he has to identify. And then he has to find them in the economy. And he has to find how political policy no longer interferes with the natural working of the economy. And that's the middle two tenets. And then the last two are how what the new policy is, how it's applied, which is one is land use to recover all these different rents from all these different natural resources. And the last one is the citizens' dividend, the phrase I'm using, that disperses it to everyone. So those are the six. He doesn't realize it until the very end.
Is a geotopia just a general world term for the new world, or is it a very specific country or city, state, and if so, where is it located?
Yeah, it is actually a particular city, state in the future. And what I had in mind when I was writing it was Portland, Oregon, because I was living there at the time. And because there's a lot of green nature surrounding the human settlement, and it's not just surrounding it, but it's actually within the city, too. And the city, to use the phrase of Frank Lloyd Wright, is a living city. And all the streams are daylighted, and you have wildlife corridors, and there's a lot of natural and human-influenced landscaping. So it's a living, breathing entity, the city, and the surrounding regions that feed into it.
Are you familiar with Richard Register's work on eco-cities? I think he's done a series of books on that.
Yeah, I know Richard a little bit. We used to speak at the same conferences. And I, like I just mentioned, daylighting streams is really visionary and coming into practice, not just in Berkeley where Richard is, but a little bit also in Portland. And I think it would be key. And I think that the biggest despoilation of city living and of nature both is the automobile. And if we daylighted streams, they'd be in competition with streets and roads. And if they took ascendancy over streets and roads, I think that would make cities great. You'd have places to walk, you'd have wildlife corridors, and you'd have clean water. So, yeah, I'd love to see that vision come to pass.
I read supposedly under L.A. there's a whole network of streams that a lot of people don't know about, but they start in the Santa Monica Mountains, and most of them basically are like run like storm drains, but most people don't even know about them.
Yeah, that's right. Most people don't know about most things, which is another reason why I want to raise awareness through storytelling, because people don't argue with stories. You know, they enjoy them, and people argue with arguments. So arguments are a lot slower way, I think, to sufficiently raise consciousness to reach that critical mass so that these ideas can become part of policy and become customary and just become the norm. So I have switched basically to storytelling.
And yeah, storytelling, writing fiction novels, science fiction novels, it's often more effective than writing an academic or political book, because sometimes people find political academic books to either be too dry, or they have a knee-jerk reaction if they say this book has a certain ideology. But if a fiction novel, you just get into it, you can enjoy the plot, the character, the twists and turns, and then that sort of, then you find out about what kind of society the character is listening to, the character is living in, and that can actually be a lot more effective as getting your point across than writing a academic or a political novel.
Yeah, I think so, 100%. I mean, you know, somebody could love Star Trek or Star Wars and have any political leaning. You wouldn't really even know that there were some visionary input into some of those stories, like one of the Star Trek movies, 5 or 6, I forget which, they talked about no money. And I thought that was kind of cool, kind of funny. I like that.
You've also written some articles on the land tax. This is for progress.org. Do you see...
Yeah.
a land tax as preferable to a tax on income? And if so, how would that be implemented?
Yeah, I think it's pretty well demonstrated that it would be better for the economy if you collected from people the value of stuff they didn't create, and if you collected from people the value of things that they did create. And everybody says, well, what about the rich? My answer to that is we're going to stop creating the rich. We're not going to pay corporate welfare anymore. We're not going to let polluters get away with polluting without paying for the damages. We're not going to let individuals collect the value of nature just for themselves. And if you did those three things, get rid of corporate welfare, make people pay to pollute, and recover the annual rental value of all assets, you wouldn't have these people who are so rich, if you were to calculate it, even if they spent like $10,000 a day, it would take them 10,000 years to spend all their money. And it's insane. It's crazy. It's even obscene. It's just not possible for any human being to earn that much money. It has to come to them by other means. And we're going to do something about those other means. But there's also some other built-in benefits to a land tax or land dues or land use fee. It doesn't necessarily have to be a tax. And like in America, there's a lot of libertarian streak in it. You can use some other mechanism to recover the value of natural assets. But when people have to pay that on an ongoing basis every month, then they don't waste what they stake a claim to. You're not going to see a bunch of vacant lots pockmarking downtown Portland or San Francisco or New York. It really blows me away. I haven't been to New York in a while. But when you walk around Manhattan, you see vacant lots, which is so bizarre in the place of highest urban value in the country. Vacant lots? How does that make any sense? Well, it doesn't. And vacant lots, they have a lot of problems. They drive sprawl. They create unemployment. It's a way to land bank. To shelter fortunes and on and on and on. Vacant apartments, too, by the way. Russian mafia owning a bunch of vacant apartments in Manhattan. So that wouldn't be possible when people are paying the locational value into the public treasury. So you get much more efficient land use, and then you can reduce reliance on automobiles, which is huge. Now, even if they had the engines all converted to electric motors, you still have the traffic and the noise and dust and et cetera, fatalities and on and on. So car use has to be minimized, and the efficient use of land will do that. And then telling owners to use their land efficiently will do that. And what else? You can't offshore it, and usually it's the local government that recovers these rents, and local governments can be more just and responsive to citizens than distant capitals. So there's a lot of good things to say about local public recovery of these socially generated values. And if it takes the form of a land tax initially before it evolves into land dues or something else, that'd be great. But politically, land taxes have not been popular. And even when they've been passed, they've been overthrown after a while.
How is a land tax different than a generic property tax?
Well, the property tax falls on both the land and the building, and the land tax only on the land. You can improve your building and not increase your tax burden, but you can't let your land lie idle in the middle of downtown and escape on a high land tax. So completely different motives. And right now, the property tax penalizes you if you make an improvement and rewards you if you just speculate and do nothing. So we would reverse those incentives.
You've also written about urban planning issues and population density. This is all connected. But do you see increasing density within urban cores and building high rises as preferable to a suburban sprawl? And what have you written on that topic?
Well, I don't know how high the high rises. The real problem, like a lot of people call Paris the queen of cities, and it's much more dense than American cities, but that's
I heard
human
it's even,
density.
That's Paris not, is even denser than New York. I've heard that.
Yeah, that's what I've read, too. And people still love it there. And it's denser in humans, but not denser in cars. And so that's the key point. And Paris, I think, what limits buildings to like six stories or something like that, which makes sense, because then the light from the sun is not blocked by really, really tall buildings. And just have a lot more within the city, a lot more greenery, a lot less cars. And you can have this density and not feel oppressed by it, not feel crowded.
And also, suburban sprawl, it's a tremendous burden on resources like infrastructure. I mean, even police, firefighters having to upkeep the roads.
Yeah. One of my fellow Oregonians wrote a book called, Better Not Bigger, and he calculated that each new house costs the taxpayer $25,000. And that's in the things you just mentioned, Robert, the infrastructure and the new schools and police, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the developer and the incoming resident, they don't pay for, comes out of the public treasury. So if everybody had to pay for the cost they impose, which I think would be fair, then we would have a lot less sprawl. And one way to do that is through this land tax idea, or land dues, or land use fee.
In your book, what is the general urban planning model? Is it more small-scale villages or more kind of a vertical living and high density?
I guess it's a combination. I read about it, but try to figure out the ideal city size. And for my own taste, it's not huge. I personally don't like sprawl for the reasons you cited. But also, there's that book, Bowling Alone, and sprawl just breaks up family and communities. And
Bowling Alone is about how societies become more, people are disconnected and more socially isolated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, sprawl plays a large role in that. I like to be able to walk everywhere, and I like to be able to ride my bike everywhere. And Portland's good for that. Portland's actually a little bit too big for my taste. I like something a little bit smaller, so I can get anywhere in the metro region on bike and get there in a reasonable amount of time. So that's my preference. I don't want to impose it on anybody. I want to make it possible for people to live wherever they want to live. And I think if we paid everybody a share of the rent, pay them a citizen's dividend, I think the big cities would get a lot smaller. And some of the small cities or small towns would get a little bit bigger and happier medium. A city would be big enough to have like a hospital, opera, and some of the other these indices that urbanologists consider. And if you have an accident or get really sick, there's a specialist close enough to save your life. And if you have a refined taste, you can go to the opera or a gallery, and et cetera, et cetera.
Can you talk about the research you conducted for Portland's mass transit agency?
Yeah, they wanted to know about funding their improvements and their expansions. And so I looked at all the other places that had done that and looked at how much land values increased in the city when mass transit increased. And the answer is land values go up high enough to to completely and totally pay for the cost of the mass transit system with money left over. But nobody has the guts to claim land value for the public. And so instead, they put mass transit on the dole, and everybody points their finger at it and say, oh, buses and trains, and they take subsidies and they cost so much money. And even though that's true, it's a misleading truth, because they actually generate a lot of value that just goes into the pockets of the speculators and developers and landlords. And none of our political leaders, so-called, have the guts to point that out and say, wait a minute. Public investment creates those values, and public investment is going to claim its share of them. And that's what some places do. Notably, Hong Kong has the best mass transit system in the world, and it takes not one penny of subsidy because it uses the land value around its transit stops. So that was the gist of my report to Portland's mass transit agency. They liked it, of course. They were quite happy with it, of course, but nothing came of it politically, which is, well, I won't say nothing. There's a tiny bit of recovery of the values that the system creates, but it's not publicly known. I don't think anybody knows much about their tax bill, what they pay. I mean, they know what they pay, where it goes and who decides and what it's for and all that. I think the general public don't really look into that.
As far as you were talking about the land tax, can you give some examples of places where it's been successfully implemented? Did you earlier say, I think, Singapore?
Yeah, Singapore is famous for it. Hong Kong does a different version. All the land in Hong Kong is public, and it's leased by the building owners. And the city government collects a lot of money that way, enough to make Hong Kong like the first or second rated city on the whole planet. And Singapore is the other one. Every year, even these right-wing groups, like, what is it out there at Stanford?
Maybe the Cato Institute, name, like, the Heritage Foundation?
Heritage. Yeah, Heritage has this ranking of cities and nations, and it always puts Hong Kong and Singapore at the top or very near the top. It never mentions why. I mean, they tell people it's because low taxes. But they don't say that, okay, what makes those low taxes possible is high collection of publicly generated land value. They don't add that part because they don't want to offend their landlord and land speculator donors here in this country. In California, there's a really big outfit, Irvine Corporation, and they give a lot of money to very progressive groups. And those groups are very silent about the things we're talking about in this discussion. And, you know, pay the piper and call the tune. It's way of the world.
You're involved with this organization, International Society for Ecological Economics. Can you talk more about that and some of their proposals?
Yeah. That was Okay. A lot of economists care about the environment, and they have started ecological economics. One of them, Herman Daly, I guess is the best known, and he used to be a World Bank economist, and then he switched over to academia at University of Maryland. My best friend was one of his students, and my best friend actually helped Herman Daly write a speech. He was invited back to the World Bank after he left.
Oh, I think it was called Steady State Economics, is his organization.
Yes, that's him. That's Herman Daly, yeah. And I know his partner was Robert Costanza, and he was curious to know how valuable the Earth is for the services it performs, cleaning the air and cleaning the water and so forth. And he came up with an assessment of $30 trillion, and that was huge news at the time, and at the time it was the most cited academic article ever in the history of academic journals. So those guys inspired other ecological economists to get together and form the society. And one of the members won a Nobel Prize, which is not truly a Nobel Prize because the Nobel family has asked the bankers to not use their name for the so-called prize in economics and call it something else. But everybody knows it as the Nobel Prize in economics, even though that's a pirated term, like slapping, you know, Levi's on pants that have nothing to do with the Levi company. And everybody would call that pirating, but very few people have the courage, I think, to call them economic prize pirating. Even I, you know, the Nobel family would call it that. So anyway, that lady, she won that prize, and she was a founder of this organization. And they are a little bit more in the school of just say no, you know, no to pollution and no to clear cutting and all that stuff. And which is a little bit surprising because it's more of a political approach than an economic approach. I mean, an economic approach would say, no more corporate welfare for loggers, no more toxic waste spilled without getting huge fines. An economist would look at incentives and whatnot, and they do to some extent pollution taxes, but actually recovering all these rents, they're a little bit shy. And partly because everybody is unaware of it, partly because most of them are successful middle-class homeowners and everybody sees it as a tax on them, and partly because there is that influence of the very rich in economics. It goes back at least a century. And so if you studied rent professionally, scholarly, you are treated as not quite an outcast, but somebody's a little bit goofy within the economics discipline. And so most economists shy away from that. And most economists don't even know it because 100 years ago, the very rich families who founded economic schools at the big name universities insisted that it be that way. And it's just lasted that way ever since. So they could be stronger in my view, even though I like them all personally and enjoy going to conferences with them. And you can really hear some really interesting papers there. So you can learn about what's going on in the rest of the world, too. Like you might think, there's no way we can get by without pesticides or whatever. And then you hear a paper read about places doing it and so forth. So
have you written some nonfiction academic books on these topics?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Barry Commoner's Closing Circle was huge at the time. I mentioned Silent Spring. And let's see. There's a few good economic books on economics. Natural Capital, I think, was one.
I said, have you written?
Oh, have I written?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I actually, as we speak, I'm in the process of writing one right now. It's the story of the intellectual quest to measure the worth of land and resources and whatnot, and why that is not an indicator. There's a ton of other indicators that are almost useless. And this one indicator, for the people who use it, they were able to predict the last recession. And they're able to do economics scientifically. And so why is there no collection of the data and publication of the data by public servants who are supposed to be serving us? So I'm writing a book on that right now, almost finished.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to add about your new book, Perfect Timing, or any of these other topics we've discussed?
Yeah, if people read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in that tone, it's comical, humorous. And if people liked Stranger in a Strange Land, it's that in the sense of exploration of a new world, with a whole bunch of new ideas and new technologies. Even for a sci-fi fan, I think we'll find some things, some surprises. A lot of what I incorporated comes from my study of anthropology. And we think of human nature as what we're familiar with, which is only cultural nature. But when you study other societies, you see humans have developed many different ways to handle the same challenges. And so that's put into the book for comic effect. And it's kind of like Brave New World in the sense that it feels familiar and strange at the same time. Fresh but familiar, and not hopeless. It's hopeful. So actually, a little bit European in the ending. American stories, everything ends nicely.
Jeffrey Smith, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Hey, I really want to thank you, Robert, for having me.